3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 4.
Country trips. Among the very fruitful experiences of my school days is a group which I cannot afford to pass over without special mention. As stated earlier, music became one of my chief studies. I had lessons in piano playing and was taught singing and the violin, and shared in the activities of both choir and orchestra. Each year, for a season of perhaps 3 weeks, this body of musical students took a concert tour in some districts of the country, stopping a night in the larger towns, and the weekend in the more important places. In advance, it was arranged with some local residents to secure us lodgings in the homes of the people who cared for us and entertained us during our short stay. Our visits were generally a sensation for the community. We arrived in state in our own railway carriage, which was shunted off onto a siding at each station where we halted. Next we were marched up to the centre of the town, our brass band blaring lively tunes to stir up the quiet streets of the place. Then we were handed over to the ladies and gentlemen who were to have us in safe keeping until the concert at night. In almost every country hall of any size, we warbled our songs and glees, and during the interval, Mr. Moss discoursed upon the work of our institution. At the close of the programme, there would be a sale of baskets, brushes, mats and knitting, all made by the blind workers. Finally, we were led off to our temporary homes by our gentle hosts and hostesses, to be handed over again at the railway station next day, when a repetition of proceedings would occur at the next stopping place. Of course, these tours were a tremendous thrill to us. They provided a change of food, of surroundings, and of human contacts. And we, who had the privilege of sharing in them by reason of our musical talents, were much envied by our poor stay-at-home mates. My personal recollections of this trooping are growing fainter. Nevertheless, some outstanding people and some quaint adventures have not gone with the years. So many kind souls received us as guests that it's a pleasure to roam in those particular realms of memory. But naturally, some personalities leave a more vivid impression than others, and the image lasts longer on that account. On one occasion, a girlfriend and I were taken into a home ruled over by a charming old lady, with her daughter second in command. We youngsters were paraded through the streets and presently arrived at a comfortable cottage. In a trice, we were dumped into chairs, our hats removed, and before we could protest, Mama was washing my face with a flannel and Amy was commanded to wash the other one. It was a merry moment for us, but we meekly submitted. Next we were led to the table in the dining room. Napkins were tucked in around our necks, and our hostess said, "Now, Amy, you feed that one, and I'll feed this one." This was too much for a couple of girls already apt to get the giggles. We had much ado to convince them that we could manage these simple operations for ourselves. I have often marvelled since then that the good people in those country towns, quite ignorant of the ways and needs of the blind, were willing to accept the responsibility of entertaining us, seeing they imagined there would be so much to do for us. There are jokes from these country excursions, too, which are still traditional amongst us. When we get together, we still laugh over the tricks of the witty but naughty Walter, who, though a pupil of our school, was in possession of partial sight. He misled an old-timer with the yarn that he could tell the colour of a horse by the trot. The old boy sent the story flaming around the town. For had not Wally distinguished a bay from a black horse on the road and done many more miracles of that kind? He did not realise that the rascal could see enough for this purpose. In most cases, these hosts of ours were temporary and soon became but a pleasant memory. But not all of them vanished when the railway train bore us away from the scene of the concert. I'm glad to record here that throughout the 50 years and more which have elapsed since my last country trip, I have often met again acquaintances of that generous period. Sometimes I'm obliged to stir up the dregs of memory to place them, but in one case especially, I made friendships of a lasting quality. On a concert trip to Colac, when I was only a child of 11, I was domiciled with Mr. and Mrs. Turner at their chemist shop. In their family were two daughters, Lily and Lou, and a son, Will. With these young people, I was fortunate enough to establish a permanent friendship, fostered at a later date by a long holiday spent for health reasons in that beautiful home. After a time, the family came to live in Melbourne, and the intimacy grew. With the aid of similar ideals and a strong personal attraction, Lily and I drew closer and closer together, and her sister was not far behind. Both of the sisters married. Lily is the wife of Mr. F. W. Bond, for long a senior police magistrate in this city, and still a very energetic worker in many religious and philanthropic causes. These two dear friends of mine spent most of their early married life in the country, and into their homes I often went as a friend and sister. They and their children have shown for me a constant affection and concern which one can expect only from blood relations. Their children, and the third generation as well, know me as aunt, and it is always my pleasure to share their joys and to lend a sympathetic ear to their cares and troubles. Louis Turner married Mr. Alf McClelland, and with this family my intimacy has been the same as with the Bonds. The children down to the third generation bring me the delight of their affection and are often in my home, so that I feel proud of this loyal association of about 60 years. Other old friends steal back to me from the past, whom I first discovered on a country trip of school days. Mr. Edwin K. Beaumont, C.E., an engineer of note in connection with the building of the Transcontinental Railway. I met at Castle Maine, where I spent a weekend with his mother and sisters. Now and then, when he has been in Melbourne, he has looked me up for a yarn and a song for old time's sake, and the sense of continuity in our mutual interests easily survives between these meetings. But one adventure of those days must be recorded more fully, as I am very proud to have been the guest of so distinguished a person as Joseph Furphy, or Tom Collins, the nom de plume by which he is better known. We had arrived in Shepparton by train, just in time to start our concert at 8 o'clock, and were rushed up to the hall, changed into our stage frocks, and the performance went on right away. At the close of the programme, my mate and I were handed over to someone named Furphy, and taken to his house for the night. I was very tired, and even now do not forget that I wanted to go to bed. Soon, however, we were seated at a table for supper, as there had been no time for tea. A gentleman with a rather sharp, brusque manner sat with us and did the honours. The first surprise he gave us was to bid us to try eating cheese with plum cake. I objected, and he said, "Have you ever tried it?" "No," I said. "Then don't say that you don't like a thing until you've tried it first." I did try it, and found it good. Next he said, "I hear you want to be a scholar. What kind of a start have you made?" I did not know. In fact, I was amazed, shy, puzzled, for I was still in my early teens. "What do you read?" he asked. Books were very limited, but we had the Bible and many of the plays of Shakespeare. "I see. What stories in the Bible do you like best?" I told him that of the prodigal son. "That'll do," he remarked. "And now, about Shakespeare, which play do you like?" The last I had read was As You Like It, and I named that at once. "Come on, then, give me a bit of that." I started The Seven Ages of Man, but had to be helped over a few slips or omissions. That ended, he began to recite, and gave me many fine selections, some familiar and some quite unknown to me. Suddenly he stopped and said, "Do you know that I write poetry?" Actually, I did not know, and in my shyness could only say that I did not remember. "Now you do not know anything about it," he said teasingly. "Listen to this." And he was off again. I wish I could say that I heard him recite this or that poem from his own compositions, but the hour was early morning, and I began to hear his voice through mists of Morpheus. So the lady of the house rescued me, and saw my dozing mate and my drooping self safely to bed. I reckon we had met a rather queer individual, and it was not until later years I read his wonderful book, Such is Life, that I realized the honor I had enjoyed, and that my host of that night in Shepparton was the famous contributor to Australia's literary treasury. Often as I read him, I recall his incisive questions, his playful teasing of a bashful young girl, and the delicious rolling of his words as he declaimed, "Henry before Agincourt," or described in Portia's words the quality of mercy. Another family whose acquaintance I made when on tour as a schoolgirl was that of the Thomases, of Milling fame. I stayed in their mother's house at Murtua, and met Elizabeth, the daughter, a little younger than myself. But this family afterwards came to live in Moonee Ponds, where I had my home with my brother, and we met in church and public life so often that it can scarcely be claimed that any friendship with them was the result of an earlier meeting. Many other of our hosts of this time I still remember, and some have passed on, and some are forgotten. Still, they were a wonderful lot, taking us in, caring for us, and cheering us with every kindly device possible, and sending us on our way with little gifts and a sense of having been welcome while we sojourned with them. The bitterness of failure. Having negotiated the hurdle of the matriculation examination, I now wished to try for a degree at the Melbourne University. It was not expected that the Institute for the Blind could finance so costly a scheme, and such outlay was quite beyond the means of my family. But I had friends, and it was decided to appeal to the public for assistance. My small success was a news item at that date, resulting in considerable publicity through the press. So the Austral Salon, the leading women's club of Melbourne, took up the matter. A big matinee performance was arranged at which some of the best artists and actors gave their services. My own excitement was so tremendous that much that happened has faded from my memory altogether. But I can recall the day of the entertainment when I was led onto the stage by Mr. Alfred Dampier and presented to the audience. I was just 17 then, a much younger person at that time than is the young lady of 17 now. Clad in a white muslin dress, I clung to the hand of my friendly guide and tried to make my bow in spite of extreme nervousness. The whole affair is a little misty, although two reminders of a material kind I still have in my possession. One, a poem in my honour, written by Garnet Walsh. The other, a black-and-white portrait by Fred Kneebone, which he gave to the Austral Salon, and which later was dispensed with and came into my hands through the good offices of my friend Mrs. Furlong. The poem will be found on another page. From this entertainment, a substantial sum was raised to start me on my scholastic career, and a tutor was sought to carry me on with my work. The lady chosen was Miss Mary Doyle, a graduate of the Melbourne University, a woman of outstanding sweetness and gentleness. Later she became Mrs. McKee, and mother of two sons who have reached distinction, one who held the post of city organist for Melbourne during a period, and the other a clergyman recently appointed to the charge of Christchurch South Yarra. This mother of gifted sons was a genuine scholar, but for some reason my studies did not prosper as well under her guidance as we expected. I do not know whether I took my gigantic task too lightly, or whether both teacher and pupil failed to realize the special difficulties confronting a blind student at that time. Our chief disability was the absence of textbooks in Braille. Every single line had to be transcribed by hand. No maternal library existed then, whose self-devoting works could help. I copied and copied through the weeks and the months that the dedication of my tutor or of anyone else I might manage to co-opt. Most of my time went in that arduous business. I got through the examinations for the first year of arts and some odd subjects for the second. Then the strain proved too heavy for me, physically and mentally, and I was forced to give up, to accept the bitter disappointment of my failure, more terrible perhaps because I had unwillingly betrayed the confidence of my sponsors. I am afraid also that it hurt my tutor sorely, for I never met her again after the expiration of her contract as my teacher. She married, and I dare say her new life held plenty of obligations as she went to a suburban vicarage. Prior to this date, Mr. Moss had died, and Mother had taken me home to live with my family. Without definite work or plans, I fretted for about a year. My health, never robust, gave us much anxiety, and it seemed probable that I might go into a decline. At this juncture, an invitation to pay the Turners a visit at Colac came most opportunely, and I was at once dispatched by train, in the hope that a change would restore me. It will be remembered that Mr. Turner was the chemist and druggist for the wide and wealthy district around the town, and in those times most of the men who followed this business were very wise in more matters than dispensing drugs. Mr. Turner had learned of a cure for tender lungs, and at once introduced it to me. Under this treatment, and with the good care of his wife, and the happy surroundings the home provided, I gradually regained both health and spirits. The improvement continued after my return to Melbourne, and I can never be too grateful to these generous friends for all the love they have given me, and possibly their gifts may include my very life. From that time, I began to long for work, for an object to aim at, both of which came in due course. I want to state, however, that throughout the years that have elapsed since that failure, I have not allowed my powers to rust. Always I have been occupied with some study, some plan of reading, some effort to build up my mind and acquire knowledge, so that I should be, though outside universities and colleges, without degrees or diplomas, a well-educated woman. Thus I have striven to use what ability I have to the best advantage, and I trust that my premier, in non-success, has been wiped out by the efforts I have put forth in the realm of citizenship in my later years. I humbly believe that the light besought by the poet in the following lines has not been denied me. Let There Be Light. Opening ode, written by Mr. Garnet Walsh and delivered by Mr. Alfred Dampier at the benefit matinee, tendered to blind girl Miss Tilly Aston, Bijou Theatre, Saturday the 4th of April, 1891. Let there be light, and o'er the waiting world the lucent tide in radiant splendour flowed, colour and form their banners brave unfurled, and decked with lavish hand man's first abode. Sunrise and sunset stained, or east or west, the golden noontide burned upon the lee, but ah, their beauty passed unknown, unblessed, by some sad eyes, the eyes that could not see. Let there be light, so every dawning day repeats the miracle of long ago, as coursers chase the night away, and all the heavens in painted glory glow. Yet midst Aurora's triumphs, rainbow-hued, when at her smile the ebon forces flee, one formless shadow must forever brood on those sad eyes, the eyes that cannot see. Let there be light, the light that fills the soul, that floods the mind, that sparkles on the lips, the light of knowledge spread from pole to pole, a sun that sets not, suffers no eclipse. This quenchless light your sympathy ensures to one sweet maid who thanks you, friends, through me, and thus, with happy years and deeds like ours, they shall not weep, those eyes that cannot see. Affairs of the heart, serious and otherwise. Generally speaking, no story of a human life gives satisfaction, at least to the younger feminine reader, does it not contain some indication of the person's response to the emotions of love for the opposite sex? Although I am convinced that love is a matter which concerns the two people between whom it has sprung up, I quite agree that its repercussions on every other aspect of life, its developmental value on general character, and its effect on those around us, are important enough to warrant that universal interest shown in lovers everywhere and at all times. So I venture a few paragraphs, since I did not escape the common lot in this. I have a secret chamber in my heart where the hand of time has hung a few pictures in this relation, and thither I go, a little pensively at times, but mostly in a spirit of kindly amusement, to meet the amorous laddies who once made me happy or sad. I need not say that to the blind is just as certain to come the touch of those passions and desires as to the younger portion of humanity in general. But with the sightless, the consummation in marriage is somewhat rarer, since most people are cowards where public opinion has to be defied. Beyond question, the majority is critical when such a union takes place. Only a few weeks ago, a woman friend came groaning to me about a dreadful thing that had happened to the daughter of her neighbour. "Doris," she wailed, "is going to marry a blind man. Don't you think it's dreadful?" I did not, and said so, and also added some further comments, which would have rejoiced the heart of Doris had she heard them. Ah, well, education is very slow in most people. Unless we recall the wonderful experiments of Jimmy Yen in his homeland of China. But let me lift the shutter of my own little chambers. Easily done now that I am past the years of hope or fear. First, there was Jack, a boy in my class at school. Right under the nose of the teacher, he would manage to slip amorous notes into my desk, commencing, "My beloved Venus," and signed, "Yours forever, the Comet." You see how wise we were. Nothing in superscription and signature to betray us to the vigilant authorities. Were there love gifts? Certainly desirable lengths of string, battered violets, purloined, I fear, from the forbidden garden of the superintendent. Finally, the engagement ring of silver, embossed with a heart and a hand, was given and accepted. Now, I do not recall how this engagement was terminated, but the ring was never returned to the lover. It lay in a spare purse at my mother's home until a burglar got in and cleaned up all my small treasures, the ring amongst them. As years went on, other boys appeared in the field. The young schoolmaster was very charming, likewise the music master, each of whom caused a flutter in my teenage heart. Then I began to get into the papers, and Roland, a young Englishman, saw my picture somewhere and wrote that he thought I would suit him for a wife. But nothing came of that. And I wandered on through the meadows of my maidenhood. Several of my blind comrades proposed to me, but although I have seen some very successful marriages between two blind people, resulting in good homes and capable children who are now fine citizens, I felt that this way would not suit me. I wanted a protector, a helper, one who could help make life worthwhile, a task which seemed beyond a man with the same handicap as myself. So these chances resulted in nothing. Many years later, Mother was approached with a proposal for my hand. The suitor was an elderly Lancashire man, a tinsmith by trade, and he put it to Mama in this way. "I wouldn't mind a respectable blind woman, and I want to get married." He sent me the gift of a beautiful washing-up dish, a sample of his skill in the trade. Mother was angry, but I was amused. And naturally, nothing came of that either, save the useful bowl, and the necessity for me to take another route when I made my shopping excursions, since I did not wish to meet the old boy. Returning to my late teens and early twenties, I recall another flame or two. There was James, who thought we might, between us, make a good thing if we went on tour as a concert party. He was a musician, and so was I. But I had been brought up in a blue-ribbon family of ultra-Puritan views, and James rarely hove in sight or smell without an overwhelming odour of liquor. So that was soon over, and James went his way. Charlie was one of my queerest admirers. He was a gardener, and posies flowed freely from his generous hand. He was wont to boast to others that we would be married, that he was buying the ring and looking out for a house. But not once did he attempt to put the vital question, nor was I aware of any deep attachment on his side. Suddenly he left for South Africa, where he died, and it was only after his death that I learnt of his statements amongst our friends in regard to this matter, and of the supposition that I had turned him down. The two men who had the greatest influence on my earlier life also came before I was 21. Both failed me. In each case, I received enough attention to engender serious hopes. There were flowers, music, concerts, and such little sweets of youth in love. In the first case, the jolt came from the boy's mother. She invited me to tea when her son was absent, working late. She behaved so affectionately to me, and leading up to the subject of her son, she remarked, "Oh, yes, and he is fond of you, dear, But of course, he would never marry a blind girl. You quite understand that, don't you? I had not the poise at that time to handle such a woman, and I went home wretched and hurt, especially as the sun did not show up as promised to bring me home. I talked it over with my folk, and the opinion was that the young man was in the conspiracy, and had left it to his mother to settle the matter with me. He came to see me once again, but his reception was far from cordial, and he did not try a second time, and our intimacy was never renewed. In due time, the other admirer was admitted to my inner self. He loved all the girls, but I really thought he loved his little Tilly the best. The affair flourished, and, as he worked and lived in a distant town, he learnt Braille, and letters passed, always twice a week. Then suddenly the letters stopped, nor did he drop in as often as happened when business brought him to town. For a time I waited and wondered, and then I wrote asking what was wrong. His reply was that he was busy, very much engaged, lots of things going on. I must not expect too much, although he would always be glad to hear from me. This letter was a shock, inducing something that resembled shame in me, for evidently I had been misleading myself, by thinking that I had, as a blind woman, any chance of winning the strong, uplifting love of a good man. Had I been stupid and vain? Once more the contempt of the other man's mother came to me with added bitterness, for I had expected too much. I had believed that love would stop at nothing, not even the condemnation of kindred society. So I sat down to do some hard thinking on the affairs of Cupid. These last two had disappointed me. I tried to believe that I had mistaken their feelings, but could not. And finally I accepted the fact that very few of us can stand up against public opinion in such matters. And I had indeed expected too much. Well, it was over, and never again would I allow such a thing to happen, for the sake of my own happiness and the trust I must have in my fellows.
And that brings us to the end of episode 4 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.